Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Novices of Lerna by Angel Bonomini. Translated by Jordan Landsman. Narrated by Paul Woodson. The Novices of Lerna. The month I graduated from university, and not exactly with flying colors, the editor of the alumni magazine asked if I would do him a big gauchada. He wanted me to write him an article. Since I didn't know how to say no, I delivered a few modest pages, mostly class notes, mixed with an abundance of quotes. That was my entire academic record, a degree I had barely obtained, and an article of dubious originality. With such a meager resume, I couldn't help but be surprised when, a few weeks after my article was published, I received a proposal from the University of Lerna. They were offering me a 6-month fellowship. What was even more astonishing was that they required, along with my confirmation, a frankly disconcerting report of my physical characteristics. Yes, the fellowship was tempting, in and of itself. Lots of money, the unilateral ability, on my part, to rescind the agreement at any time, paid travel, paid clothing, life insurance, the possibility of taking classes in my field as well as others, not a single subsequent obligation, publications or reports. A true sinecure that would also give me the opportunity to see the world. But in addition to the unexpected offer and unusual requests, there was something else I found unnerving, the tone in which the letter from Lerna was written. The syntax was generally unobjectionable, but the tone aroused my suspicion, due to how cloying, cautious, and bland it was. An example. Illustrious Dr. Beltra, the humble and traditional University of Lerna, dedicated, as your eminence is not unaware, to legal studies and the social sciences for more than 2 centuries, contacts you, the eminent doctor, by way of this humble servant, the letter was from the rector, so that you might have the generosity to... As you can see, the university was extremely humble, the rector a servant, and I was illustrious and eminent. My porteño nature could not help but suspect that this was a joke orchestrated by some maula who fancied himself a humorist. I went to the Swiss embassy, where I was put in contact with someone named Curelli, who mysteriously already knew who I was. What's more, he had copies of the letters they had sent me from Lerna, which formed part of a voluminous dossier labeled with my name. Intrigued, I tried to find out what the hell was in this monstrous compendium, but the attaché Curelli, the 4th or 5th in the embassy, vaguely dedicated to cultural information and affairs, categorically refused to let me see it, and he was not very polite about it either. My experience at the embassy, although briefly disturbed by this promptly forgotten incident, achieved its goal. It dispelled my suspicion that the invitation was the work of some jokester. And so I wrote to Lerna to communicate my acceptance in principle and to announce that I would send them their copious forms as soon as I had them ready. To this letter, I received a reply dripping with syrup, written so mawkishly that it wasn't just cloying, but actually repugnant. I knew at once I would need help filling out my physical information on the questionnaire. It was impossible to take the requested measurements without someone's aid, and it would be difficult to convince anyone that I wasn't filling out the application for an insane asylum. For example, I had to provide the measurements of my biceps when they were hanging by my side, as well as completely flexed. When we were younger, I had struck the same pose in front of my cousin Lisandro to prove that I was stronger than him. Therefore, it was Lisandro himself to whom I turned for help. The measurements were so detailed and varied that someone could have easily reproduced my body down to the millimeter. The form was 7 pages long, each one brimming with check boxes. The photographs, the cost of which was covered by the university, demanded a greater exercise of patience and will. Believe me when I say that the sacrifice they entailed nearly dissuaded me from the trip. They required such an exhaustive survey, so to speak, of my poor body that by the end I was stripping off more than decorum permits. It was my sense of humor and Lisandro that got me through it. My cousin photographed me partially and totally, and from every angle imaginable. The delivery of these materials to Europe was handled by the 4th or 5th attaché at the embassy, who had also provided us with cameras, film, lenses, lights, and many other gadgets. A few days after I finished the mountain of paperwork, I received another letter, this one markedly unpleasant. It seemed I was Lerna's ideal candidate. The rector, deans, department heads, and a whole string of authorities affirmed and signed and stamped a declaration that congratulated themselves and me for a happy end to the negotiations. In the same envelope was a check that somewhat alleviated the stupidity of the letter. My flight was scheduled for the first Monday of December. Lisandro, kind-hearted as ever, strove to dissipate my growing concerns. How could I pass up this opportunity? My abnegation had to do with the humiliating nature of their requests. But to Lisandro they were just examples of the watchmaker's spirit so typical of the Swiss. Watchmakers or not, they had managed, with their gloved and affected means, to which I am so hostile, to put me between a rock and a hard place. The end of October came, and I had to resign my position at the court, or ask for a leave of absence, if I wanted to travel on the date set by Lerna. Resigning was out of the question. I knew my leave would be granted automatically for a fellowship like this, but I asked with the secret hope that it would be denied. Judge Riera, who has known me since I was a child, was so moved when he read my request that he almost cried. I felt like I was being ambushed. As a rule, a porteño is reluctant to abandon his neck of the woods. I spoke with Lisandro about Lerna until he was bored out of his mind. I went over the facts. The Swiss are Swiss, and there was no reason to be surprised by their strangeness. Accepting the invitation would bring me the following benefits: a guaranteed promotion when I got back, the chance to disentangle myself from a few women who were beginning to complicate my life, an economic solution for the next few years, if I reconciled myself to saving a little bit of the large quantity of money provided by the fellowship, a visit to Europe, and, as Judge Riera put it, the incredible opportunity to move away from one's country and see it with the double perspective of time and distance. Personally, I couldn't care less about the latter, but considering the scarcity of favorable elements to tip the scales toward accepting, I opted to consider it. The prospect of being promoted didn't move me either. I know full well that it's best to limit oneself to a tiny position in order to live in peace. To become the registrar, the manager, the chief, is to make the same deal as the toad who traded his eyes for a tail. Goodbye to drinking two glasses too many. Goodbye to staying up late reading. Goodbye to friends. Goodbye to women. The part about the women had its advantages, but I couldn't help being upset by this imposed separation, and, perhaps most importantly, having to abandon the conflicts that dating more than one woman simultaneously implied. Visiting Europe is something that every Argentine keeps in reserve as an unquestionable inheritance. Going there is almost a disappointment. The economic solution was a bit questionable. There was no need to solve something that wasn't a problem for me. I always felt saving money was useless. I don't have the capacity or the need to save. I spend what I earn, and no matter how little it is, it's always enough. In addition to all this, as I already mentioned, I didn't deserve a fellowship. I hadn't asked for one. The application process made me suspicious. The tone of the negotiations was highly disagreeable, and, in an imprecise but unavoidable way, the entire thing inspired in me a sharp annoyance, an uncontrollable distrust. However, as if a foreign will were exercising itself over my decisions, I embarked, to be precise, I took a plane, on the date indicated by Lerna. At that point, my experience in the air had not exceeded 400 miles. A one-way trip to Cordoba. On the return trip, I traded the flight for a bus ride. I must confess that my flight to Europe was very enjoyable. I fell in love with a flight attendant, Sandra, and we had the good fortune that certain mechanical breakdowns delayed the flight for 38 hours in Lisbon. My ticket gave me the choice of taking another flight to Geneva or waiting in Portugal. I stayed. Sandra would fly out of Portugal, but now we had one day and two nights ahead of us. Oh, how I was later nursed by the memories of that young lady during my solitude at Lerna. I had no idea of the importance these few Portuguese hours would have in my future. We spent almost the entire time in a small hotel, whose railings and windows were reminiscent of the decor that amateur theaters use to portray the peninsula. Sandra was very warm. She was very sweet. For my own part, I knew that I had to act economically. That is to say, to capitalize on that skin, those eyes, that voice. Because it would be a while before I encountered them again. I'll admit, it was with a utilitarian sense that I looked at her teeth and smile, as I tried to fix in my mind her ordinary gestures and casual remarks. I wasn't going to see her again for 6 months, and so I let her enter my memory like an army of details, whose aim was to invade and occupy me, but in which I would find my nourishment. I thought to myself, I'm falling in love voluntarily. Later, in Lerna, I would make a daily, meticulous consumption of that premeditated stockpile. On occasion, I had to attend to that abundance of health and beauty just to restore my sanity. I arrived in Geneva the afternoon of December 7th. Separating myself from Sandra was hard. I found the city horrible, a sort of public relations office, where what's on the surface just barely disguises the hidden truth. On Sandra's recommendation, I took a room in the Hotel Krasnopolsky, which she had visited during her travels. The idea that she had been there, in perhaps the same room I was staying in, made me happy. I imagined her moving around from one side of the room to the other. Lying on the bed, not thinking about Lerna at all, I retrieved every moment I spent in Lisbon, and in some cases, corrected past situations in my mind to improve the memories. At noon the following day, I had to take a train to Umsk, the nearest town to the university. I went out that night to eat, and afterwards slipped into a movie theater that was showing a Western. My memories of Sandra were weighing too heavily upon me. I slept poorly my first night in Switzerland. I ate breakfast late and left directly for the train station. During the trip, overcome by fatigue, worked up by the plane, by Sandra, by our goodbye, and by Geneva, and facing the prospect of having to meet new people, I navigated extravagant half-dreams with the foggy image of Sandra in the ever-present background. I got off at the dark and deserted platform in Umsk. My only luggage was a suitcase. Once the train had left, I tried to make my way with the insufficient help of a few pale streetlights. The area was mountainous and heavily wooded, surely a typical one-horse mountain town, and at that hour of the wintry afternoon the people tucked themselves into their houses. I thought it would be unobjectionably clean, the gardens cared for to a depressing degree. There would be traffic lights, even though drivers were respectful of transit laws to the point of religiosity. I was having these thoughts when I saw a man wearing a pale blue jumpsuit walking toward me. His gait was elastic, and above all very quiet because, evidently, he was wearing rubber-soled shoes. Despite the weakness of the light, my surprise increased as he walked over. When he said, "Good afternoon, Dr. Beltra," I nearly fainted. Was I speaking, or was he? "I'm Gonsalves, an engineer by trade. I've come from Lerna to pick you up." The scene was dreamlike, but reality made it exaggerated. My own voice, my expressions, my face were coming from another person and directed at the inanimate stone to which I had been converted. Gonsalves added that he was Portuguese and that he was one of the fellows invited by Lerna. I registered this information in a very confused way because, instead of listening, I was completely focused on his appearance. How could I cross the Atlantic, fall in love with a woman, sleep in foreign countries, and after an exhausting train ride, arrive somewhere new, only to realize I wasn't myself anymore? How could I be this benevolent Portuguese engineer, coming to pick me up and bring me to a legendary university? Gonsalves's silence gave me time to contemplate the horrifying possibility of my own depersonalization, and perhaps even my own death, which may have already occurred without my having accepted it. "I know we look very similar," he said suddenly, as if he were reading from a script. "It's precisely for that reason that we're here. Furthermore, as I will soon explain, we're not the only ones. There are 24 fellows, and we're all identical." When I finally snapped out of my stupor and put out my hand to confirm that both of us were alive, I began breathing normally. But I had to make an enormous effort to speak. "Wait a second," I said. "This requires an explanation, and, if possible, at a bar with a whiskey in front of me." The man agreed. "The same thing happened to all of us. This isn't the first time I've come to pick up one of the fellows." He took my luggage and walked toward the exit of the platform. A Swiss in uniform, I don't know if he was a policeman or a railroad employee, greeted us courteously as we passed. We got into a small car that was very warm. "Finding out you have a twin at my age?" I said, as if not speaking to Gonsalves. "It's even more surprising to find out you have 24 twins," replied the engineer. I sat next to him in the car, but avoided looking at him out of discretion. But after a while, I couldn't resist the temptation to observe his mannerisms. He was absolutely identical to me. What's more, as I watched him closely, I discovered several details that corresponded to me, but that, of course, I had never seen in my own face. Seeing one's own mouth smiling, one's own eyes looking, but not in a dream, right there, a foot and a half away. To see one's identity moved, displaced onto another person that, in some sense, is oneself, I felt a wave of hatred, and it seemed to me the theft was of a different magnitude than the one I had until then granted it. In a very concrete way, I realized I was capable of killing this man. Insofar as he was himself, I didn't make any sense. He denied me the simple and rudimentary grounds for feeling like myself. I understood that when he smiled my smile, he was stealing my doubts, usurping my anguish, squandering my happiness, putting himself in Sandra's eyes and my parents' graves, sweeping away my past, and crushing my future. And so, as if I were a little drunk, I said to him in a voice that trembled but was full of import, "I am Ramon Beltra." And he, speaking as though he were strengthened by the security of his disdain or the annoyance of his fatigue, replied, "Yes, and I am Julian Gonsalves." But a few blocks away, I was invaded by another wave of something like compassion. I thought about how his heart was pumping with blood just like mine, how he must have gone through the same childhood anguishes, experienced the same pain, mourned the same deaths. He'd felt the same emotions that I had over the course of 24 years of life. But the strange thing was that my life, which had been tolerable, and even somewhat pleasurable, seemed too painful for this man with my voice. "Look," he said, addressing me informally, "there's a place on the corner where we can get a drink." We stopped. We got out. We ordered whiskey and coffee, That is to say, 2 whiskies and 2 coffees. The waiter seemed accustomed to receiving a set of twins who were, without him realizing it, always a different pair. We drank. First the coffee, which was very hot. Later, slowly, the alcohol. I stared at him intensely, especially when he didn't notice I was doing it. The following day, I would be dressed the same, in a pale blue jumpsuit and a pair of rubber-soled shoes. One of the university's rules was that no one be distinguishable by their clothing. Rings were forbidden. Haircuts were mandatory at the beginning of the month. In terms of academics, each fellow created his own curriculum. Or he didn't study at all. Or he read, or wrote, or played sports. Gonsalves, for example, having arrived at Lerna a few days earlier, was taking a course on electronics in the School of Mathematics. During our chat, it came to my attention that the dormitories were situated around a circular corridor, onto which every door opened. The corridor encircled a grass-covered interior garden with a fountain, also circular, in the middle. The dormitories, in reality they were apartments, were numbered. For now, Gonsalves was in apartment number 20. I said we'd be seeing each other often. Yes, he replied. Every day. But it won't be easy to recognize each other. I didn't reply to this observation. The only thing that occurred to me was a somewhat silly question. Was there a rapport between the fellows? Of course there is, man, said the Portuguese. We're not savages. We left the bar and got back in the car, and 10 minutes later we were going up the mountain by way of a tortuous corniche. Lerna was a little more than 12 miles away. It was an old stone building, modernized on the inside and built on a tract of flattened land, situated among 4 peaks of average height. The plain resulted from the convergence of 4 valleys, and had the benefit of offering a country-like landscape, rather than that of an oppressive, mountainous region. Lerna sat at the highest altitude of any populated place in the area. The building, dating from the end of the 17th century, was built by the French Benedictines, who had barely, or perhaps never, inhabited it. Lerna's theological investigations had begun obscurely, but it was definitively established as a school of theology under the protection of a group of wealthy nobles who preferred anonymity, perhaps due to the heterodox nature of their research. It was said that, in exchange for Lerna, one noble had given the order a property in the south of France. In addition to the ring of 24 apartments, the monks built several wings that split off from the circle. In Lerna there were usually some 200 students, or novices, as they were occasionally called, probably due to the university's origin, staying in the wings or pavilions. But every 5 years, the university went into recess for a year, and the students abandoned the premises, while the majority of the professors traveled to other centers of study. Only a few teachers remained at Lerna and continued their research linked to the old house. Theology, mathematics, and law. This was a recess year, and the university had invited 24 professionals from different parts of the world. The 24 of us were physically identical. We entered via a gravel road lined with enormous trees. There were remnants of a recent snowfall. The path led to a grand building of irregular ashlars covered here and there by ivy that had been defeated by the cold. We left the car and crossed the threshold of an enormous hall. An extremely dignified-looking old man, dressed in an impeccable tailcoat, conducted us to the rector's office. He appeared to be mute. Before I went in, Gonsalves said goodbye. "We'll see each other later, I hope," I said. "Yes, of course. I hope so, too," he replied, in a somewhat melancholy voice. The rector wasn't so humble anymore. He seemed cold and distant. He greeted me and handed me a folder in which, he said, I would find the rules and layout of the university, a list of courses, an explanation of the mechanisms for communicating with professors, a schedule, and all of the other information necessary for living in Lerna. Today is December 8th. On June 8th, I will see you at the same time to say goodbye. That is, if you haven't decided to leave before that. Ignoring my protests, he got up, and, walking slowly and deliberately, accompanied me to the door. His office was really a luxuriously furnished library, where, despite the large lit fireplace, there floated a delicious perfume of wood and tobacco. Upon leaving the office, I was once again received by the old man in the tailcoat. He wasn't mute. He told me that I would find my suitcase in room number 24. He accompanied me to the circular hall and said goodbye with a tilt of his head. Judging by the distance that separated one door from the other, I guessed that each fellow had his own large apartment. The circle of the hall, or gallery, was no less than 90 yards in diameter, and it did indeed surround an interior garden with a marble fountain in the center. The fountain resembled a sort of giant pineapple, which shot thin streams of water. I was passing apartment 22 when I saw one of the fellows leave wearing his pale blue jumpsuit. I couldn't contain myself and yelled, "Gonsalves!" The man came up to me and said his name was Jacques Dornier. He was studying theology, and he was Belgian. He was identical to me, that is to say, to Gonsalves. Dornier wished me luck and left, and I walked to my room, ill-disposed to say hello to anyone, no matter how similar to me, Dornier, or Gonsalves they might be. The door to my apartment opened into a spacious foyer. I turned on the light and closed the numbered door behind me. In addition to the foyer, I had at my disposal a magnificent bedroom, a large bathroom, a study with a fireplace, and large windows that opened onto the opposite side of the circular hall. The furniture was solid and dark, the floors carpeted, and next to the desk there was a large console with a record player, tape recorder, telephone, speakers, and radio. I opened the heavy curtains. From the window I could make out the deep and wooded night blending into a starless sky. A brief note lay on the table. "We request that Dr. Beltra change before leaving his room. He will find his clothing in the dresser. Administrative Secretary 365. I undressed and went into the bathroom. The abundant and heavy shower seemed to revive me from an old, almost forgotten death. I put on the pale blue jumpsuit. Looking at myself in the mirror, I couldn't help but think of Gonsalves and Dornier. Wearing unusual clothing is alienating, but this jumpsuit also evoked the two people I had seen wearing it. I thought about how, in a way, having the same face as other people was a means of disappearing from the world. A uniform equalizes and at the same time depersonalizes. But when a group wears the same uniform and its members are also physically identical, more than just equal and depersonalized, individuals are almost invisible. I strolled over to the telephone and dialed 365. A man answered. "Is it absolutely necessary that I put on this onesie?" I asked with obvious impertinence. "Yes," he said. Since I had expected some type of explanation, I ceased this line of questioning to hide my impotence and added, "I wanted to know where the dining hall is." Unruffled, like a machine, the man told me that, "Between rooms 8 and 9 you will find the door corresponding to Wing D. To the right, about 20 yards from the entrance, you'll find the dining hall. There's a detailed map of the entire university in your folder." I hung up without thanking him. If they were going to be curt with me, I hoped they would remember that I was a porteño, a specialist in maintaining my distance, and what's more, completely devoid of faith in that thing people call warmth. I left my apartment, and after passing room number 8, found an enormous door identical to the one between my room and room number 1, and to the door between rooms.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?